Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue discussing our favorite 100 movies of all time. Today we are on episode number 84, movie number 17 in our top 100. Talking about The Godfather from 1972, and John has the final replacement of this entire series, Midnight in Paris, being discussed instead of his real number 17, which is his real number 1, Casablanca. We'll be talking about Casablanca in a couple weeks. I forget exactly where I have it. I think I have it right at 10. I think it just makes my top 10, have it there. So we'll be talking about that one in a couple weeks. But instead, we have Midnight in Paris filling in for Casablanca. Almost had ourselves a podcast of two movies considered to be the greatest movies of all time. Instead, yep, we had to butcher it and instead put Woody Allen into the conversation. So, John, why'd you pick Midnight in Paris over Casablanca, or as your replacement for Casablanca? And it's our final one, so you know, it you is. Really had to go out on a high note.
So we've already talked about it, right? Casablanca, on my many rewatches of it this year, is going to be my new number one movie of all time after this. And what I felt was, because when we were coming up with our replacements, we were coming up with these things that were vaguely related to the movies that we were watching. And you can't. Casablanca is just on another level when it came to that. And it was impossible to find something that was similar to Casablanca that wouldn't feel like we were just watching bad Casablanca. Mm-hmm. So I just took the most famous line, or not the most famous line, but one of the most famous lines from Casablanca, "We'll always have Paris." And I was like, Midnight in Paris is a great movie that is so, I think, is a perfect conceptual movie. And while it might not be perfect in practice, it's still good enough and distant enough from Casablanca that I don't feel bad mentioning it in the same sentence as Casablanca.
Yeah, so when this movie first came out, I absolutely loved it. Loved it. And rewatching it this time, I started to understand a little bit of the criticism of this movie, which is it is such a name drop fest. But yeah, I still really enjoy this movie. I mean, Woody Allen just has a way of taking romantic comedies and making them a little bit more intellectual and making you feel a little bit smarter watching them. Even though if you broke this down beat by beat, it's really no different than freaking Dear John or something. You know, it's like it's the same as all of those movies. But Woody Allen adds his own touch to it. I always love watching a different character play Woody Allen, which Owen Wilson is playing Woody Allen in this movie. I always think that's very funny to watch somebody else do Woody Allen's neuroses, because that's just pure entertainment. Midnight in Paris is one of the most entertaining movies to come out of the last 20 years. Like, it's entertaining. Like, whether you love it or don't, this is a great movie that you can just throw on anytime, sit down. It's going to put you in a good mood. Like, it's just a fun movie. The character, the actors were having a really good time doing this. You can see it in all of them. I mean, Adrian Brody with one of the great cameos of all time in this movie as Dali. That is like, it's just, it's classic. And I do, I think it's a really good fill in for Casablanca. We'll talk about The Godfather second, obviously, because it's on both of our top hundreds. And
yeah.
People might have heard of that movie, and it might have been the highest grossing movie of all time when it came out. But, you know, so I want to, normally we kind of lead with both of them, but I just think Midnight in Paris has something magical about it that a lot of movies that try to emulate Woody Allen can't do. I know Woody Allen is like a very despised person in Hollywood because of his personal life and everything like that. And I'm going to be honest, I don't know the full details of his personal life because I feel like over time, his personal life has been so blown out of proportion. It's not a defense of Woody Allen or a whatever of Woody Allen.
Indictment?
Thank you. I couldn't think of the word indictment. Thank you. It's not a defense or an indictment of Woody Allen. It's literally just me saying, I believe that his personal life has been so blown up and it's such a game of telephone that it has just gotten out of control. And so, you know, I think the number one Letterboxd review is like, how did such a human piece of waste make this movie? But I am a big proponent, and I've said it on this podcast a bajillion times, I'm a big proponent of separate the artist from the art. And with Woody Allen, that's something like, I love Woody Allen movies. I have not seen a Woody Allen movie that I didn't like. And that's because I don't watch all of Woody Allen's movies. You know, Midnight in Paris, I think, was the most recent one of his movies that I saw, because everything that came after that really didn't get good reviews and didn't do anything commercially. But Midnight in Paris just has such a nice touch to it. And that magical realism that he's able to implement people try to emulate it so much. And they tried to do it before that, but I will say that I think Woody Allen does magical realism and nostalgia better than any director ever in the history of cinema. Now we're talking about Cinema Paradiso next week, and that's one of the most nostalgic movies of all time. But Allen just gets it. He just gets it. Like, I watched The Purple Rose of Cairo for the first time in 2022, and that was my third favorite movie of 2022, and it's an 80-minute nostalgia trip about movies. Mm-hmm. He just understands that so much better than others, and you're not sitting there watching this movie saying, oh, well, how is Owen Wilson back in time? How'd he get there? And then he just comes back. Like, you're not worried about it. And I think that's what's fantastic about it, because Woody Allen just lets you let your guard down enough and lets you willingly suspend your disbelief.
Yeah. And I mean, the time travel element of this movie is one of the things that fascinates me the most of it, because the seamlessness that Woody Allen brings it into the movie and just continues it is phenomenal. It's one of the best introductions of time travel in a movie ever, because it doesn't seem out of place. You essentially go through the same journey as Owen Wilson's Gil does, as he's like getting to the point where he understands that he's gone back in time. And it's not that big of a deal. He's like, yeah, this is incredulous, but it's also awesome. And you kind of just delight in it. And yeah, we get all of these people's names being dropped left and right in this movie, and it seems like every time we go back, we meet someone else. But at the same time, it feels fun because it has that air of that delightfulness of Paris, and that's the big thing. That's why we start this film with this montage of the streets of Paris. Mm-hmm. It's exactly how Woody Allen treats New York. It's the exact same thing. He's just doing it with a different city that you didn't expect him to be able to do it with, but he's able to take this romanticism of Paris. And this is again why I took it as this replacement for Casablanca, because in Casablanca, the whole bit about Paris is about the romanticization of what happened there. And that's what this entire movie is, just romanticizing Paris and looking back on a time that seemed so much better than the present.
Yeah, and I love that it asks that question throughout, right? Like, I love that we get the Marion Cotillard character Belle Epoque would have been better. It would have been better. I'm telling you, I live in 1920s Paris, and I'm telling you, it is not as good as Belle Epoque would have been. And I think that's how everybody feels, right? Although, I will say that I don't think there's as many people clamoring for the early 2000s or 80s or 90s as there are who clamor for still that idea of the 20s and the 30s. And I think like pre-depression, obviously. But I think that there is something about not actually being able to see something that makes those time periods so much more compelling. Because pretty much 1920s anywhere seem awesome, right? Like, it's because we don't have video footage of 1920s everywhere. You know, like, we have some movies that came out in the 20s. I'm not saying we don't, but nowadays it's so easy to see what the 90s really looked like. We just watched Reservoir Dogs last week. Like, you can really visualize what the 90s looked like just by Michael Madsen's character in that movie and the clothes that Chris Penn and Lawrence Bender wear. You know, so I think that Woody Allen does such a good job of that. We don't, like, we have this image in our head of what this was like. And now we're living in it, and it's kind of like that, but you're also only seeing the fun bits. He's only seeing midnight to 3 a.m. in Paris during this time. He's not seeing the daytime. And you know, my wife pointed out, where's all the homeless people? Like, where's, like, the disgustingness and whatever disease was probably going around Paris in the 20s. Like, that, I think, is what Woody Allen just does such a good job of that. And he gets into that mentality where no matter what time period you're living in, you always feel like, man, would it have been better if I was just alive during then? Because realistically, people just want to experience it all and they can't.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the reasons why I think the 20s is so, it's such a good choice here is, A, you had all of these American authors who were just in Paris during the 20s, and all these artists who were in Paris just, you know, living that post-war life of excess, right? Mm-hmm. This is coming off of World War I. This is arguably one of the biggest times of excess in the last two centuries. Mm-hmm. And it's just, but it has that emphasis on art too. And that's why it's so important that Gill is this struggling writer who's done the shill jobs, right? He's done the movie scripts and everything, but he wants to write his novel now because he wants to experience art. And, like, that's what's so good about this movie. And that's what delights me about this movie. Like I said, not perfect. I gave it 3.5 stars. I think you did too.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it comes from the fact that Gill is just feels like what you want to feel like. You want to feel like you can create art and you can just experience art in a way that is uninhibited by 2010's limitations.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, Paris now is, you know, are a lot of places now, tourist destinations all over, like all the big cities, all the romanticized cities are tourist destinations. That's why people love going to, like, Greece and going to the Greek Isles, because you're out on the islands of Greece and, you know, Athens is a tourist trap. But if you go out onto certain islands in Greece and certain parts of it, it's, like, uninhabited. It's unreal and it's different. And I think that it's hard to find that in France, because the most beautiful part of France, Cannes, is overblown now because and Monaco and all that, they're all overblown because of all of the things that go on there. You know, these huge festivals, the races, whatever. And then you have Paris, which everybody's going to go to Paris to do the tourist kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's this idea of this was before it was a tourist destination. This is when people lived there, when people really went there and lived it. They just lived it. The writers went there to get away, to be together, to be creative, to think, to be around each other. That's the myth, right? That's what goes on there. And, you know, as Gill is saying throughout a lot of this movie, he's wondering, he's looking for that place for himself because he doesn't trust anybody to read his work. He feels like he's surrounded by these pseudo intellectuals who don't know what the hell is going on, but think they're smarter than everybody. All these people who, like, don't appreciate art. And ultimately in this movie, it takes the poorer girl, the poorest person probably in the movie, in both time periods to kind of to wake him up to that, because they do have an understanding of art. Now, him and Marion Cotillard don't agree, because she wants Belle Epoque and he wants the 1920s. But he has found somebody in the present who has the same appreciation for nostalgia as him, because they're not taking for granted the places they're going. I love all of these scenes with Rachel McAdams and her family, where they're always at like the fanciest, nicest restaurant. They're always at the nicest garden. They're doing all this amazing stuff, but they're not just experiencing what the real Paris is, what a person who really lived in Paris would do. And that's what Gil wants, and that's what Woody Allen gets at the heart of, because I don't know if there's many people in the history of film who make their settings characters better than Woody Allen does.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. When you see Gil and he just wants to, when he expresses his intent just to walk in the streets of Paris, you can connect to that and understand that, because we're seeing this contrast of this hoity-toity, like very Americanized version of Paris, and he wants to experience Paris itself, the city. And I mean, it's been a long time since I've been to Paris, but even then, I didn't really enjoy the touristy stuff. I enjoy just walking the streets and like feeling the history of Paris as you go around there. And again, that's why Woody Allen starts this with this montage of the streets. It's such a gorgeous city when you're looking at like the architecture and just the way it's built. And yeah, it has those iconic monuments, but it's the little things in Paris that really give it the heart. And that's what Gil is expressing this entire time. And simple things like him deciding to walk home instead of taking a cab, or even better yet, the conversation that opens and closes the film, of the idea of Paris in the rain, and how it's an even more beautiful city in the rain. It's these little moments that really make you connect to Gil. And despite the fact that there are moments where you kind of like sympathize with Inez, in the end, it's all about Gil and the way it's like this bohemian lifestyle that Gil is kind of manifesting into the audience.
Yeah. And I love those little details, right? Paris in the rain. Why is there that mentality, right? That things at night when it's lit up, they're more beautiful, or when it's rain, like when things are off, they're always nicer, right? Because it's not what you get all the time. You get the sun most of the time. So it's this illusion again, that something is better because you remember it, or because it's been romanticized so much. Woody Allen is a big proponent of that stuff. I mean, a lot of what made Woody Allen so successful is his ability to take the things that people have romanticized, dramatized, all of that, and take them to the nth degree. You know, the end of Manhattan when he's running down the street. I mean, he really understood those climactic moments and how they aren't in reality, but how we create this image in our head that they're going to be reality. And his characters always seem to get that reality that isn't real. And that's what happens in this movie. He finally gets the rain. Walking in the rain anywhere sucks because you're wet and it's clammy and it's gross. I hate walking in the rain, but it also depends on where you are. It's not like I wouldn't go out in the rain. I'm not going to sit there and be like, oh my God, I need an umbrella. If I'm in Disney World, yeah, I'm walking around in the rain. I don't care. I'm not putting a poncho on so I can hold all my sweat in my body. That's disgusting. But I just think there is that idea, right, that you're going to walk the streets of Paris with a beautiful woman in the rain and be inspired. This movie came out 7 years after Before Sunset, where they walk the streets of Paris and they're inspired. There are locations, there are exact shots in this movie that are in Before Sunset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that just goes to show how important Paris is as a character in this movie. And like you said, Woody Allen captures that wonderfully, because there is even the moments where it doesn't feel like it's like where it feels more generic as a setting, it always feels like Paris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially when it's contrasted by how absolutely American Rachel McAdams' family is in this movie.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's a fun element too, right? Because Woody Allen always gets into that out of place feeling. When we watched Annie Hall, a lot of like what he talks about with when he goes to LA, he just doesn't feel like he belongs. And the fake laugh tracks and all of that, and all of those really Americanized things. Woody Allen really gets into those. Have you ever seen Vicky Cristina Barcelona, or The Purple Rose of Cairo, which again, like I said, that's like the Depression era type movie. He really does like to get into that characters out of place in a setting, because that helps also elevate the setting that they're in, because it allows more characterization of the people who feel comfortable in that setting. And then we get to learn more about them as characters, and it speaks to just who they are. They type A or type B kind of personalities. So I totally agree. And yeah, Rachel McAdams' family is that stuck up family that goes to Europe because they can, because they have the money to go, and they come back and they tell everybody how wonderful it is, but they don't remember a damn thing. They don't care. They didn't make a single memory that was worth remembering.
I think the scene in the film that really gets me with them is when they're looking to buy the $12,000 chair.
Yes. Yes.
And it's that moment where it's just like, these people, you can't connect to these people. Like, these are just a different type of people. And that's what I love about this contrast between Inez and Gil. It's just that there's a point early on the film, and it's such a throwaway, but Rachel McAdams says, but he makes good money. And you think that that's like, the way it's phrased at the time is it seems like it's like a, oh, well, he also does this. And then as you progress through the film, you realize that's kind of the more important thing in this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's the fact that like, she doesn't want him to write this novel. The novel is a silly idea. Just keep writing movies. That's what you're good at anyway, honey. Just write the movies, like make as much money as you possibly can. Don't try to do something that's highbrow. That's not going to make you any money. Do what you're good at. That is what her family is raised on, right? Like that's what we're seeing throughout the movie, to the point where their daughter is blatantly having an affair, but the father is sending a detective after Owen Wilson to see if he's having an affair, because the affair that's happening right in front of his eyes, he doesn't care about, because he doesn't think this guy's good enough for his daughter anyway, because they don't think he makes the money or does any of that. Like, it's very funny. Those little interactions, right? It reminds me of in Annie Hall, the scene where he's at the dinner and she says, did you? And he's like, Jew. She said, Jew. You know, she said, Jew. And he's sitting there with the long Jewish curls, and he's got the nose and the hat. And like, it's so overblown. But now that's what he is feeling like. Like, Owen Wilson is constantly sticking out like a sore thumb amongst this group. Because again, he's making his money through art, and they don't understand that. They understand the intellectual explaining the art with Michael Sheen's character, which is a fantastic character.
But he's terrible.
He's awful. But the pedantic fellow, that is absolutely. My favorite. But that character, they appreciate and they understand and they like. They don't understand the person who can't sit there and give all the information about it, because he's not an intellectual. He's an actual artist. And I think that's a good juxtaposition without Woody Allen having to say the brutal line of, oh, artists are just misunderstood. You know, he doesn't have to say that. We get that, because the intellectuals understand. He must know everything. Everything he's saying must be true, because he teaches it. He knows his stuff.
Well, and I love this. Like you said, I do really appreciate this character of Paul, despite the fact that he's like one of the most despicable characters in probably any movie ever. Because, man, there is no one worse than a know-it-all. And that is all Paul is. And there is a point. So I was watching this with my roommate, and he mentioned Paul used a lot of like interjections while he's speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at Versailles. He noticed it right away. He's like, why does he keep saying like at the beginning and and to, like, taking these long pauses before speaking? And it's because he's flying by the seat of his pants most of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a bullshitter. And, but he just sounds confident.
And I love that critique of like academia in this film, where and we get it several times, right? Like in Versailles, he's the know-it-all; he knows everything, and the information he's saying is true. But then we get to the Musée de Rodin, and he's talking about Rodin's mistresses, and he's getting it mixed up with who's his wife. And then we get the scene where they're looking at the Picasso painting that, you know, Gil was there when it was painted. He knows exactly like the motivation behind this painting. And everyone brushes him off before Paul's like lame brain explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, that's the kind of stuff, right, where I always say whenever we watch a movie that's historical, mm-hmm. and now the new school thing to do is say that's not what it was really like. Like I always think about with when Game of Thrones was on, right? People would always talk about, well, that's not what the middle ages were like. People weren't actually being like you can look up the statistics for like how many people were being like murdered, beheaded, raped, all of that stuff. And right. It's like, yeah, I'm sure they were keeping great fucking tabs on that. But it makes me laugh because the new thing to do is that's not what it was really like in 1880, right? Dances with Wolves isn't accurate because that's not what it was like, or that's whatever. Yeah. Any movie, you can do that. Any book, any story, any whatever. Were you there? Were you there? Or is that just what you're hearing now because that's the narrative that is being spun? I think that's a very fun way for Woody Allen to get at his hatred for these people who feel that they're better than everybody. And are like, because, you know, this was a time where people were, you know, starting kind of like, everybody changed the narrative on everything all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a really nice way for him to get to the heart of that without just coming out and saying, I hate these kinds of people. Like, you make an ass out of them. It reminded me of in The Fablemans, and spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen The Fablemans, but at the end of the movie, when the guy films the high schooler, and the high schooler's like, you made me look like a god. I can never live up to that. And he's like, I just pointed the camera. What are you talking about? It just said what it said. I didn't do anything. That's what this feels like with Woody Allen. He's saying, I don't need to say you're an ass. Everybody knows you're an ass. Because Owen Wilson never really says anything bad about Michael Sheen's character in this entire movie.
No. No. Because he's not that type of guy. And that's what it really comes down to. And that's one of the reasons why you like Gil so much in this character. It's like, even when we get to the point where, you know, Gertrude Stein's explaining that Hemingway didn't believe that the protagonist wouldn't see that his mm-hmm. wife's cheating on him with the pedantic one. And like that moment and like that realization. And it's still just like, he just feels so sympathetic. And I think that really does come down to casting for Owen Wilson. I think Owen Wilson is the perfect person for this role. I think this is one of his best performances. And it's just like, yes, it's the same character Owen Wilson almost always plays, right? Like that sappy, mm-hmm. love-struck guy who's like kind of meandering and losing his way. I mean, it's pretty much his characters from the Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah.
But
he almost got an Oscar nom, too. Well.
Yeah, he pulls it off so well. It's just like when you're good at something, you do that something. And Owen Wilson has found his niche with this type of role.
Well, and that's like with Woody Allen, right? If you watch a Woody Allen movie, all of his movies have the same tone. Everything, you know, with the exception of Match Point, which is a very good movie. Match Point's darker than his other movies, but they all have that same tone. Their protagonists are all identical. And then when he finally starts making like female-driven movies, they're all identical. Like everybody is the same. But that's what Woody Allen was doing, and he was churning out movies like crazy. And it's a personality trait that people enjoy watching because when you walk around Paris, don't tell me you don't have that feeling of I don't belong if you don't speak French or if you don't do like if you aren't from there. But you want to experience it. But how do I experience it? What's the proper way? And when would have been the best time and all that? It's a fun look at all of that stuff. And again, I talk about this all the time, but it's going there. It's mm-hmm. saying this is what the premise of the movie is, and now I'm going to go there. He doesn't need a time machine. He doesn't meet some mysterious person in a bookshop who gives him a book and he says some spell, and now he transports himself. When he gets drunk and wanders the streets of Paris, the car just picks him up. And I love the end scene with, I hired a detective to follow him. Well, what happened? Well, I don't know. The detective's missing, and they show him back in the Renaissance. That scene is freaking amazing. Because it shows that it's not just happening to Owen Wilson. Had Rachel McAdams stuck around, she would have traveled with him back to the 1920s.
Yeah. And he wouldn't have seen like this nut job that they thought he was.
Yep.
Yeah. It's one of the best depictions of time travel, I think, in any movie. It's simple. You don't need an explanation for it. All you need to know is that it happens.
Yeah.
And by doing you know, having the detective go back into the Renaissance and having that second trip back, it just goes to show that it can happen to anyone as long as they have that desire and that passion for her, for that forgotten time.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that it's kind of brushed over, because like the ending of this movie is kind of the point where I have my like problems with it. Everything with like Lea Seydoux's character feels very like not fleshed out enough.
It's the ending. I think it's the ending audiences wanted, right? It's just give,
yeah,
like bring her in.
I get it, but I feel like it wasn't fleshed out quite enough. Because like she has like 5 minutes of screen time in this entire movie, mm-hmm. like through the three scenes she's in. But more importantly, like in that trip back, Gil mentions that like you can't live here. This is the present, and that's supposed to be this moment of like realization for him. And I feel like we never quite get to that point where we understand Gil has come to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think the one thing I think that's really holding this movie back.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think the thing with Lea Seydoux that's interesting now is she's so recognizable, mm-hmm. that I think it actually hurts that role. Because at the time, Woody Allen just found a
French actress.
A normal-looking French girl.
Yeah.
And now Lea Seydoux's become like hot as hell. And she's like, you know, she's incredibly well known. She's in a Bond movie. Like she's, you know, blue is the warmest color. She was in whatever the Wes Anderson movie, The French Dispatch. She's in all of that stuff. So she went from being like the cute shop owner to literally she's naked for like 5 straight minutes of screen time in The French Dispatch. So she's become now like a sex symbol. I think that actually kind of hurts the end of this movie a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not his fault, but she's become too recognized.
No, it's not. It's not at all. But like, and like, I do really like the ending, because I really like I said, I really like the bookends this movie puts on it. And the fact that like Owen Wilson finds this character who understands him and his nostalgia, mm-hmm. but keeps him in the present. I think that's really important. I think it's just a little understated.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think a lot of this movie, and the reason why I keep this movie at 3.5 instead of 4, I think a lot of this movie is surface level, but that's fine, because this is a great Friday night in movie. This is a great any night of the week in movie, and you're drinking wine watching this, and it makes you want to go to Europe, though, that's for sure.
Yeah, it does. I definitely feel the passion to go back. And the other thing that I really like about this film, though, is it's really easy to share with people.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to find someone, because it is kind of surface and it doesn't have like those really deep symbolism or anything like that. It's really easy to just show people and be like, hey, this is a good movie, and they understand why it's a good movie.
You'd be hard pressed to find somebody who doesn't like this movie. You might not find somebody who loves this, but you'd be hard pressed to find somebody who says that's a bad movie.
Mm-hmm. And before we move off of it, I do want to mention Corey Stoll's performance as Hemingway.
Amazing. Yeah, I was going to say the same
thing. So good.
Yeah. Yeah, Corey Stoll as Hemingway is unbelievable in this movie. He should have been nominated for supporting actor. When the SAG Awards, so because of the way that the characters are listed, right, they do it in alphabetical order, starring, and then they do co-starring. Corey Stoll is listed at the end of the co-starring. He wasn't nominated for Best Ensemble at the SAG because of that, because there were only so many characters they could do, and they do it in order.
Oh, no. That's awful.
Yeah, I know. It's unreal.
Well-deserved. I mean,
I don't know if they've gone back in time and changed that, but I remember at the time that was like a big thing of like, that's an insane snub, because he is amazing as Ernest Hemingway in this movie.
Yeah, and like, respectfully, like Kathy Bates also fantastic as Gertrude Stein's, and Adrian Brody as Dolly is hilarious. Just talking about
Fitzgerald, Hiddleston as Fitzgerald is good.
Yeah, like the ensemble cast of this film really pulls it off. But Corey Stoll's Hemingway, he just feels like Hemingway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the funniest part is, like, when you look at Midnight in Paris on, like, the front cover of, like, the DVD or poster or whatever, Kathy Bates, Adrian Brody, Carla Bruni, Marion Cotillard, Rachel McAdams, Michael Sheen, Owen Wilson.
Yeah.
No Corey Stoll, no Tom Hiddleston, no Alice Pill. Like, it's crazy. And, like, a lot of these actors became huge. I mean, like, mm-hmm. like Tom Hiddleston is massive. Yep. Not in 2011, he wasn't.
Nope.
But, all right. What was the best thing you watched this week? We have the same answer, so this will be an easy one.
Yeah, we do, because I watched it, told you I watched it, then you watched it. It's a Streetcar Named Desire. Easy, hands down. No question about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it was funny because I haven't seen that movie in probably about 10 years. Warner Brothers was doing like a sale where they were doing their Blu-rays for like you could buy like five for 20 bucks or something. I bought Streetcar and Out of the Past and a couple other movies. And you said, I'm on a Brando kick. I'm going to watch this. I was like, you know what? I have to rewatch this movie. I hadn't seen it in so long. One, it's laughable that Humphrey Bogart beat Marlon Brando for Best Actor that year. Have you seen The African Queen?
I have. I'm much higher on it than you are.
Yeah, The African Queen is a steaming pile of shit. It's a steamship going through shit. That movie sucks. Humphrey Bogart is hamming it up so much in that. But even aside from that, even if you like The African Queen and you like Humphrey Bogart in that movie because you're blind and deaf, but you do, right? Marlon Brando's performance in this movie is so absurd. And he was unknown at the time. He hadn't been in any movies. Like this was... I don't know if this was his film debut or not, but this was like the first time people really took notice of him. He is so ridiculously good in this movie, which only makes it all the more impressive what Vivian Leigh does in this movie. Because Vivian Leigh gives one of the all-time great performances in this movie. Like, she's incredible, but it won three of the four acting categories. The only one it didn't win was Marlon Brando, because Carl Malden won supporting actor and Kim Hunter won supporting actress. So it won everything except Brando. But such a great movie. And just like, so, and Tennessee Williams just had that biting dialogue, man. He really did.
He did. It's so good. If you don't realize how impactful the title of the movie is until you really get into it. And then just like the reflection of Blanche as this trauma victim, it's played so well, and it feels, the characters in this movie feel like real characters, and like they feel like real people, and that's what makes it so well. I mean, I give it 4.5 stars. I'll be shocked if it doesn't make my next iteration in my top 100.
Yeah, I also love the addition of like the house that they're in and how it's just falling apart as Blanche starts losing it more and more and more and more. Yeah. And this movie, when it came out, was so heavily censored. I have like the less censored version. They're calling it the original restored. I highly doubt that everything they wanted in there, but they originally didn't even want to, because of whatever codes were in place in 1951, they were telling Elia Kazan that he could not even imply that Blanche was raped. And they, Tennessee Williams and Elia Kazan and all of them really fought it. And this was the first time that rape was even hinted at in a movie in 1951. Mm-hmm. Now you think about that, all those film noirs and stuff, they always make it seem like everybody was consensual in that stuff. Like this was the first time that it was like in your face and allowed and approved and all that. And it was a big moment. And I actually read an interesting article in the LA Times from 1995 about that today after watching the movie, and how like it was such a big moment for free speech and everything like that. And now we're at the point where it's like, okay, how can we make this rape seem more gratuitous? Like, how can we do that? Like, it's just gotten so out of control that when you look back at what A Streetcar Named Desire was able to accomplish without showing anything.
Yeah.
It's really incredible. It really is.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Yeah. Great movie.
So good.
Definitely worth a watch.
Yeah.
Well, and it's all because of Marlon Brando, and which is my number 17, The Godfather, which John had lower, but I think, what'd you have it at? Was it 25 or 26?
Something around there. We watched Goodfellas instead.
We watched Goodfellas instead. Yeah, that's true. So it was only a couple weeks ago that John would have had it, but The Godfather. I mean, this is going to be a hard one to talk about, because what really can be said about this movie that hasn't been said to death? Generally considered the greatest movie of all time, generally considered the greatest American movie of all time, up there with Citizen Kane and Casablanca. It's always those three. Every now and then you'll get Vertigo thrown in, but that was really just BFI saying, like, we don't want it to be Citizen Kane anymore. Let's be real. So The Godfather, when it came out, the expectations weren't high. Al Pacino was an unknown. Marlon Brando had been a box office disaster. It was very fun to watch Streetcar today and read about his rise, fall, rise. Because in the 60s, Marlon Brando was poison. Mutiny on the Bounty was a disaster. Sayonara is terrible. His movies just weren't hitting. And The Godfather hit, and it's the highest grossing movie of all time at that time, beaten the next year by The Exorcist. So it held that title for 1 year, but we're starting to get into kind of that blockbuster type thing because 3 years later with Jaws. But The Godfather, what I'm always amazed about with The Godfather is that Marlon Brando wins the Oscar for Best Actor. Mm-hmm. This is not Marlon Brando's movie. This is not Vito Corleone's movie.
No.
The through line in The Godfather Part 2 makes Vito Corleone more of a main character in that movie than he is in the first one. He's not the main character of this movie. Michael Corleone can't be the main character of this movie because he's not in the first hour. He's in 5 minutes of the first hour of this movie. We see things through his eyes, but that's it. Fredo certainly isn't. Fredo, it always blows my mind that John Cazale as Fredo is barely in this movie. You don't even realize that there's another brother at the wedding scene until he drunkenly comes over, which, by the way, John Cazale, one of the all-time greats. I've talked about him before, but, every movie he was in was Best Picture nominee, at least. And then it's not James Caan. He dies. It's not Sonny. Oh. It's not Tom Hagen. But if you think about it, it kind of is Tom Hagen's movie a little bit. But all of that is just to say, to make a three-hour ensemble movie in 1972 – make it feel so realistic, have a through line, have an arc for every single character who's in this. Clemenza has an arc. Tessio has an arc. Kay has an arc. They all have arcs. Johnny Fontaine has a freaking arc. To have all of that happen is just incredible. It's just incredible. And to the choice, the decision to tell the story in the order they tell it in is what makes The Godfather so monumental. Because if you really think about this movie, throw away the fact that Michael has to go to Italy because he kills the cop and he kills Sollozzo. Throw away the fact that Sonny gets killed and it's because of the five families. If you look at the big moments in this movie, they could have happened in any order. But they start with the wedding to show the gigantic family, to show how important the business is, to show the type of people who are there, to show the power that Vito Corleone has. They do that, and then they go to the horse's head right away to show the absolute power that these people have. It's brilliant because it sets the tone for the rest of the movie that they will literally do whatever it takes to get what they want. And as Sonny takes that too far, and as Vito is getting too old, Michael perfectly starts to go into that role. And it's just flat out brilliant, the order that this movie is told, because it is a bunch of random events that could have happened in any order.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to punctuate everything in a specific order in order for it to have this impact. And I think the biggest thing with The Godfather, despite the fact that The Godfather is a title for Marlon Brando's character, for Vito Corleone, this movie is about family. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we get this three acts where we get the Vito storyline, the Sonny storyline, and then the Michael storyline to finish us off, that's so important, I think, to the heart of this film. Mm-hmm. I was just like, this movie is about family. It's not about a single character, because everything they do is for their family.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what makes it so interesting, right? Because you just said the first act is really about Vito. Vito's power, what he has, all that. The second act is Vito's now in the hospital. It's about Sonny and how is he going to take over everything, because Michael has to go to Italy and all that. And then the third act is about Michael and that rise, because Sonny's dead and because Vito is just you know, he's dying essentially. He's too old. He can't do it anymore. And Fredo's a bitch. So what do you do? But like I said earlier, who's the one character who is there for every single part of that? It's Tom Hagen. Tom Hagen is the through line for every character. He's the one who is explaining to Kay what's going on with Michael. He's there explaining to Vito at the beginning who the people who are coming to see him are, making sure they can come in. He's the one explaining to Sonny that you can't just go to the mattresses, which, by the way, I love go to the mattresses. That's amazing. And he's the one who gets kicked out when Michael starts to rise to power, but he still stays on his side as all of that's happening. And he's there. I always thought it would have been Clemenza. Nah, Tessio was always smarter. Like,
yeah.
Tom Hagen is there for every single important moment in this movie, or he is the one who is helping them navigate every important moment. And he gets so undervalued because when people talk about Joel Grey winning the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, they always talk about how it should have been James Caan or it should have been Al Pacino. Now, I'm not going to argue that either of them could have won this Oscar, but Robert Duvall's name does not come up enough in that conversation. And Robert Duvall's acting in this movie is incredible. Like, it's incredible. Joel Grey won because these three guys split the vote. Yep. Joel Grey still was phenomenal. I think it's one of the best supporting actor wins of all time. It's a phenomenal performance. But how do you choose between Tom Hagen, Sonny, and Michael, who are all so incredibly different and so integral to the story, and they all come across in different ways? How do you choose between them? You can't. You literally cannot. But that's why I think it's interesting. If Marlon Brando wasn't the title role in this movie, first of all, it wouldn't be as good. But if he wasn't the title role in this movie, would that character have been a supporting actor nomination? Because think about it. The other three weren't well known at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have just been a supporting actor nomination? Because he's not in any more of the movie than Michael or Sonny.
No, he's in about the same amount, and I don't know. It's a good question. I can't possibly determine what the Academy would have thought at that point.
Yeah.
I think he's still the title character, though, right, mm-hmm. is the big thing. And I think that's what makes him the best actor instead of, like, the best supporting actor.
But who's the real godfather in this movie? Well, it's Michael.
It's Michael. Yeah. There's literally a scene with him becoming a godfather.
That's what I'm saying. So
it's arguably one of the best scenes in all of cinema. So.
Oh, yeah. The baptism by fire scene is incredible. But with Vito starts as the godfather. But I think what's interesting about this movie, right, is because we really see this with the rise and fall of the mob, right? The mob was the mafia, the mob, whatever you want to call it. It was around for so much of the beginning turn of the century America, and it went into the 40s and the 50s, and then it started to bleed out, and you know, and now it is what it is. But I think what this movie really is about, as you were talking about family, it's about legacy. And the Godfather isn't one particular person. The Godfather is the idea of the head of this family who has all the power, who can control everything. And Vito dies, and now it's Michael. And in The Godfather 3, which is not a good movie, you know, it's okay. Okay, it's not bad. I can't, like, trash it that much. It's just over long. It's just drawn out for no reason. But even in that movie, it's who's going to replace Michael? Like, that is what the conversation is. The Godfather is something that just keeps going. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that it's The Godfather, but that's just kind of who's going to take over as the next Godfather. It's the Don. It's Don Vito Corleone. And then it's Don Michael Corleone. Like, that's what it is. The Godfather just happens to be, because of Sicilian heritage and all that, it's just a very highly respected position that they give the mafia boss because they want to stay in the good graces.
Yeah, exactly. And what a better way to establish it than this opening sequence.
I know.
Just like having this man just talk about how his daughter was assaulted. And, you know, it starts with the voiceover, then it goes into him, and he's all we see. And then we get Brando's response to it. It just shows how powerful the man Vito Corleone is immediately. You don't need to know anything else, you can just tell by the way this man is talking to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love how this movie gets into, I mean, the first line of this movie, which is about family and America and legacy and all that. I believe in America. That's the first line of this movie. The first words you hear are, I believe in America. From a dark screen, you don't even see who the hell it is. I believe in America. I think, like, it's amazing how Coppola was able to get into the American dream with all of this, too. Mm-hmm. Because when you see where I'm going to the town of Corleone, I'm going to the town of Corleone, goes to Corleone, and it's this mountain village. It's just a village in the middle of nowhere. You see that Vito Corleone came from nothing, absolutely nothing. And now he's one of the most powerful men in the world. That's the American dream, right? The American dream is I can go from nothing to a billionaire and own my own house and do all that. That's what the American dream is. And I think this movie really gets into, in that time period, how difficult it was for a lot of like Italian Americans who were coming here because of the stigma that was associated with them. Mm-hmm. And I believe in America, like they were being ostracized during this time period. Yeah. And the way that they fought that off was with the mob and the mafia and all that. And then that made them even further ostracized half the time until they started paying the money for it. So I just think Coppola navigates so many themes in this movie and so many characters. And we talk about like Lawrence of Arabia as an epic. Like I truly believe that Lawrence of Arabia is like the greatest movie filmed. I'm not saying it's the greatest movie ever made, but it's the greatest. What that is putting on film is unbelievable.
Yeah.
But in terms of a sprawling epic, nothing touches The Godfather because it is a sprawling epic. This movie goes all over the place. They're in Los Angeles. They're in Sicily. They're in New York. There's different main characters throughout. They're all well-developed, but it's all over the place. It's about relationship in America with Kay and Michael. We see Sonny cheating on everybody. Once you have the power, you do whatever the hell you want. We have Connie getting the shit kicked out of her by Carlo, her piece of shit husband. Like, we have all of that stuff going on in this movie. And how does he cram it all in? The extended version of The Godfather is just as good. Most movies aren't as good. Like I talked about this with Apocalypse Now, right? Apocalypse Now, the theatrical version is a perfect movie. The Redux is not a perfect movie. We see that all the time. The Godfather, the stuff that they cut out, is so damn entertaining and so good. Have you ever seen the Clemenza goes in and sits down and eats at the restaurant scene?
No.
So when they're going to kill Pauly,
yeah.
When he goes to pick up the cannolis, he sits down and eats an entire plate of pasta there. Tells him he's going and he's got to do some work. He sits down and he has a whole meal while they're sitting there waiting in the car. That is amazing characterization for Clemenza. Now, obviously, that gets cut from the movie because Clemenza is the 9th or 10th most important character in the movie. But that just shows what Coppola wanted to do with all of these people and how they're all a family, how they're all important in some way. Because without Clemenza, as we know from Godfather 2, Vito Corleone never becomes Vito Corleone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. It's that it takes a lot to have that type of intricacy within your characters where they are so reliant on each other for their positioning in a film. Mm-hmm. And that's what The Godfather does really well is, despite the fact that, you know, you're listing off a bunch of Italian names, we still know who each and every one of these characters are. Mm-hmm. And they're so well defined that we always know who's in a scene. It's like that movie's 3 hours long and you can go an hour, hour and a half without seeing a character, but you still know who they are when they're on screen because Coppola just develops them so well with whatever screen time they do have.
Yeah. I think about with Luca Brasi, right? Like he's barely in the movie. But Kay draws attention. Why is that man over there just like repeating to himself? Oh, no, he's coming. Oh, that's Luca Brasi, blah, blah, blah. And Michael tells that story and you say, Okay, that's Luca Brasi. All right, let's do it. He put a gun in his mouth and he said, either your signature or your brains are going to be on that paper. Like, now you know that character. And then we also know the intensity of which when he's going to Salazzo and he's going to Tattaglia's, that's incredible because Luca Brasi dies within what, the first half hour, 45 minutes of this movie? Mm-hmm. And yet you really feel like he's such an integral character. Or he's going to be because of how well he is characterized early on. I think a lot of times in new movies and like screenplays, not just new movies, it's movies throughout history, but in movies that miss the mark, a lot of the time it is because they aren't able to establish who everybody is well. Like what I really enjoyed about Babylon is a sprawling epic. But you know, like it gives each character their moment when they walk on screen. Paul Thomas Anderson is phenomenal at that. He does that in Boogie Nights with Burt Reynolds and Julianne Moore and Mark Wahlberg. Everybody gets their moment that you're going to remember them. John C. Reilly doing the how much you bench and then turning the blender on when he answers. Like it's brilliant. Coppola does that probably the best it's ever been done in this movie. Because that wedding scene, you are introduced to Vito, Fredo, Sonny, Carlo, Connie, Michael, the mother whose name I don't ever remember, Tessio, Pauli, Clemenza, Luca Brasi, Tom Hagen, Kay. I just named 15 characters. Johnny Fontaine.
Yeah.
And you know where every single one of them stands within this family, within this whole thing. The mother keeps her head turned away to all of it. Sonny's the hothead going out and beating the shit out of the FBI, throws the camera on the ground, throws money at him. Fredo's the drunk, pathetic brother they don't talk about. Michael is clearly Vito's favorite, but that's his family. That's not him, Kay. Like, it's not me. Luca Brasi, Tom Hagen, we know where all of them are. How do you do that in 30 minutes? And I love Cabaret, right? Like, I have Cabaret. Bob Fosse, phenomenal direction. Bob Fosse won Best Director that year. Just for the first half hour of this movie, Francis Ford Coppola was the best director of this, of that year.
Yeah, and I mean, when we're talking about his direction on top of that, like, there are some incredibly memorable scenes. You mentioned the horse head scene earlier. I always forget how early in the movie that scene happens. Because it happens right after the wedding. And I'm like, oh, there is a horse head already.
Yep.
And it's such a terrifying scene. Like, it's these little things in this film that make it so good. It's when Michael goes to, is in the restaurant. And like, or even let's proceed that with the scene where Michael comes up with the plan.
Yep.
For the restaurant shooting. Is one of the, I texted you while I was watching the film. It's one of the greatest character flip moments in a film ever. It's the moment where you understand Michael, not Sonny, is in charge of this family now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unbelievable, right? And we see that whole in that scene. It's you're taking it too personal, Sonny. And then Sonny goes over, you're taking it too personal. Oh, it's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business. Like, it's brilliant though, because up until that point, Michael tries to keep himself out of it. He wants, you know, he doesn't, that's not him. He knows what goes on in that family. He's the war hero, right? Like, he's done what he needs to do. And that's made his father proud. That's what he wanted, right? This is not meant to be his business. But when he goes and he finds out that his father's not being taken care of, and he realizes that it is his business because he's a Corleone, and they say, oh, they know he's a civilian. Doesn't matter. Right. We see that after the I don't know if it's the Michael scene, whatever, when everybody's just turning up dead, all the mobsters are hitting each other. It doesn't matter if you're a civilian or not. If you're in the way, you're in the way. And he realizes that in that hospital scene. And when he goes out with Enzo the baker and they're standing there and pretend you have a gun and they're both pretending they have a gun, it shows that Michael understands it in a different way than everybody else. And when he starts going at Sterling Hayden, who is phenomenal in this very small role that Sterling Hayden gets. He starts going at him and Sterling Hayden punches him in the jaw. Now Michael's in it. Because now, yes, he was a civilian, but he just got punched in the face by a crooked cop. And Michael might not have the temper of Sonny, but he's got more of a temper than his father. And he's just as smart business-wise as his father is. And that moment when he sits there and he says, you know, I whatever he says where he could kill them, mm-hmm. it really is. It is that turning point that turns a good character into an iconic character like Michael Corleone is.
Yeah, and then we have the actual scene where he goes and kills these two guys too. Mm-hmm. It's so meticulously constructed where, you know, we know the plan. We are told the plan prior to this scene coming out. We know how this scene should play out. Mm-hmm. We see Michael get up, goes to the washroom, struggles a little bit to find the gun. Makes you think he might be a little bit nervous. Maybe he's not going to pull through with it. And then he comes out and he's out in the restaurant. And again, the plan was you just come out of the bathroom, pop, pop, make sure they're dead right away. And there's this pregnant pause until the train goes by.
Yeah.
And then that's the moment where Michael does it. And it's just, it's so beautifully crafted. It's genius what Coppola's done in this scene.
And remember, Michael, when you do it, then you walk out, you lower your hand, you drop the gun. He throws the freaking gun. He looks everybody in the eye and he throws the gun. Because it's also in that moment. And then, yes, he has to flee and he goes to Sicily and all that. But in that moment, Michael is now the face of the Corleone family. And it doesn't matter who knows you if you're the face of the Corleone family. We see that with Vito. Everybody knows Vito, how dangerous Vito can be and all of that. Nobody's arresting Vito Corleone. Nobody's arresting any of his people. We never even hear about the idea that any of the people are going to be arrested. Are they going to get killed? Not arrested. Nobody's arresting the Barzinis, the Tattaglias, the Cuneos, the Stracchis. Nobody's arresting anybody. And in that moment, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm in and I'm not coming out. This is it. I'm going to flee to Sicily. And Coppola gives us that belief that, oh, maybe he did get out while Sonny's getting murdered and Vito's coming back to life and all of that. Maybe Michael will get out. Maybe he will. And he gets married and he's in Sicily and everything's going great. And they blow up the car, one of the people who was closest to him. And in that moment, it's, I'm not close with anybody here. I need to go back where I belong. And it's time. It's just time. And it's just, it's fantastic. I mean, it's so well done. But again, like I was saying with like the random things, right? They could have done the horse's head later. They could have done the Sollozzo Luca Brasi stuff later. They didn't have to do Sollozzo so early on in the movie. Sonny doesn't die till 2 hours later. And we end up finding out it's Barzini anyway. But all of that stuff, it didn't have to happen in the order that it happened. Vito Corleone doesn't have to get shot as early as Vito Corleone gets shot. Most movies would wait to shoot Vito Corleone. But that's what sets The Godfather apart from everything else, because it's unlike anything else that's been made. It really is to this day.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably only one other movie that comes close to what The Godfather is, and that's its sequel.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And the funny thing is, The Godfather 2 is probably a more impressive movie than The Godfather 1. I think The Godfather 1 is better, but I think The Godfather 2, the fact that it tells two coherent storylines about a rise to power. Find me a movie that has one coherent storyline about a rise to power that's as good as either Vito or Michael Corleone's in the second movie.
Yeah,
that's so impressive. It's so impressive. And I think what's impressive about it too is that you went from the first movie, which was kind of an ensemble, whatever, to this is about Michael and Vito now. Mm-hmm. This is about Michael. And it's about Michael ending that part of the family.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And I also love at the end of the movie when he kills Carlo. And, you know, once he finds out that he killed Sonny, he didn't know for sure. And then that facial expression changed. Like Pacino was just on another level. And Connie comes in, did you kill them, you bastard? All that stuff. And then Kay says, don't ever, you know, she asked, did you do it? Don't ever ask me about business. And he goes, you know what? Just this one time. Did you? No. Like it is. Think about where that character started and think about where that character ended. And that's a supporting actor. supporting act. It's just, it's another level.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why people say this is one of the greatest American films of all time.
Yeah. It's just, and I think the other thing that's impressive about it is it stays fun too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's enjoyable to watch these characters do what they're doing, which yep. isn't always the case with like these mafia movies. Goodfellas, you have a good time watching them. This movie, you have a good time. A movie like The Irishman, it's no fun in watching those characters, right? Like The Sopranos, the reason it was so successful is because it's fun to watch them. But The yep. Godfather was really that first mafia movie that made them, that humanized the people and made them fun. Sonny is mm-hmm. such a bad guy, but he's everybody's favorite character in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, and like they really did make it fun. I mean, I love the scene where they're just sitting around eating Chinese food before when they're waiting for the phone call and Michael can't eat because his jaw's wired shut. It's fantastic. Yeah. They're all sitting there and they find out, and that's when Tessie, they got one of the old toilets with the little I mean, they make it so damn enjoyable. I don't know. It's just it's a hard thing to pull off. And like that's where Coppola, man. Like I think about with like William Friedkin and Francis Ford Coppola, each of them had like two great movies, like two all-time great movies. I'm talking with French Connection and The Exorcist and this and Apocalypse Now. And it's funny that they really never hit – well, and obviously when I say two, I mean Godfather 1 and Godfather 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, my bad. But it's funny that like they weren't able to achieve that with other movies after that, despite how distinct their style was and how like clear their voice was and how well they were able to build characters and world and all of that. The world building in The Godfather 1 is ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But like why – like I don't know. Coppola just – he wasn't able to hit it again. He just wasn't able to hit it.
When you make one of the greatest movies of all time, it's hard to live up to that again. And he still managed to do it twice afterwards. So that's pretty impressive.
It is. It is. I guess what I more wonder is like what happened to Francis Ford Coppola after 1979, right?
Do you not remember Bram Stoker's Dracula?
Okay. But like what happened to him? Like still. Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do. Just like,
I don't know.
He let his daughter take over.
He did. And you know what? That's okay because I have his daughter's movie ranked higher than any of his movies. So
there you go.
How's that make a lot of you cinephiles feel? Huh? How do you feel about that? Sofia Coppola is a better director than Francis Ford Coppola. Yikes. Okay. Yeah. My bad, everybody. Hey, Lost in Translation is a masterpiece. Everything else she's done is meh. Virgin Suicides is good. Virgin Suicides is solid. But yeah, I really enjoy The Godfather is a movie that never gets old. And that's saying something because I grew up in a family where this movie was watched once a year. You know, it was a religion. It wasn't just, you know, my dad is Sicilian. So it was like, no, this is how it was. Thanks, Dad. Thanks, Dad. I'm sure you loved the 40s when you were born in the 60s. That sounds good. But anyway, fun fact that I found out today. I just want to stress to everybody who is watching this, and then we're going to end. Marlon Brando was 48 years old in this movie. Probably younger when they were filming, but he was 48 when this movie was released. 48 years old. It's so stupid. I say that because it just exemplifies how brilliant this performance really was. And, you know, if you read history on The Godfather, they were terrified when they were shooting the first scene and Marlon Brando was randomly holding a cat. This movie was supposed to be a disaster. Brando was cold. Pacino was an unknown and he wasn't that good looking. It was a problem. This was supposed to be a disaster. Yeah. The 70s were full of those types of movies that were supposed to be disasters and ended up being masterpieces. So anyway, all right, John, that's all we got. Next week, we're going to the 80s for the final time on this podcast. Can you believe that? That's the final time.
Is it really? 80s.
Yeah, in the 16th slot, we both have movies from the 80s, and then after that, neither one. Oh no, I lied. I'm a piece of shit. You have the thing.
I have an 80s film at number four. There's one hiding in there. It's hiding amongst the rest.
I was really excited because I really wanted to emphasize how bad the 80s were, but you have the Thing. But it is crazy that, like, from here on out, we are loaded with 60s, 70s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s. And we have one more 80s movie after next week. So it's kind of crazy. That is interesting. But anyway, we're doing Evil Dead 2 from 1987 in Cinema Paradiso from 1988. And I'm just going to argue that 1982, that's just the 70s senior. You know, it was still the 70s.
I'd agree.
Yeah. So Evil Dead 2, 1987, Cinema Paradiso, 1988. Two very different movies. Thankfully, the Evil Dead 2 is super short. So at least I can, at least we have that going for us because we have some long ones coming up. But that'll be a fun podcast. Make sure to tune in next week. Probably again next Thursday if you're around. We'll probably just do that. And then, yeah, we only have 16 episodes left. John and I today started discussing our plans for what we might do in the future once we get done with this top 100. For anybody who wants to know what that might look like, I'm going to be sad for a lot of it. And not in a way of watching sad movies. I might be a masochist for the idea that I presented to John earlier today, but we'll see how that goes. Maybe that'll get some conversation going. What do you guys think it's going to be? But that's still going to be like 5 months away. So who the hell cares? John, thanks a lot. Thanks as always, everybody. Godfather. Here's one for you before we go. Godfather move up on your list or no?
If anything, I think The Godfather Part 2 might have moved up on my list. By the way, okay. I mean onto my list. After watching The Godfather.
Yeah, because you had The Godfather at 31. Do you think it probably stays there?
Probably. Maybe it moves up. It might. Well, I'll have to watch it again.
Yeah. Yeah, I have it at 17. This used to be a top 5 movie for me. I'd probably keep it around 15, 20 in that range now, though. But we'll see how these next 16 weeks go. I might have a change of heart on some movies. But anyway, that's what we got. See everybody next week.